We're looking this evening at those words we read earlier in Isaiah 56 and 57. And I've called it this evening, God's gracious invitation. God's gracious invitation. And in this chapter, or two chapters, we meet two groups of people. Two groups of people. If I told you one group was called the bad, who'd you expect the other group to be called? There's the bad. Who'd you expect the other group? Maybe you'd expect them to be called the good, but they're not. They're not. There's two groups of people here. There's the bad and the repentant. So there's no one good. Sometimes we think of it like that, and we, even as Christians, can sometimes think of people in those categories, whether there's good and the bad. But there's not. There's no one good. We're all bad. But there is a difference. There are those who are bad, and there are those who are bad but repentant. And that really comes across in this chapter we're looking at this evening. There's two groups of people. They're both bad. One group are repentant too. First, in the middle bit of the passage that we read, 56 verse 9 through to 57 verse 13, the middle chunk of these two chapters, which do really fit together, the middle bit is taken up with that grim reality of sin. And so that middle section, 56 verse 9 through to 57 verse 13, look at that reality that everyone is a sinner. That's our first point this evening, that everyone is a sinner. And we're all sinners because, well, of various different reasons. One, because we were born in it. Is there in 57 verse 3. But come here, you sons of the sorceress, you offspring of the adulterer and the harlot. Then again, at the end of verse 4, are you not the children of transgression, the offspring of falsehood? We were all born in sin. That's mentioned many times in the scriptures. Here Isaiah does it very colourfully, doesn't he? He doesn't just say that, we're born in sin, but he says, you sons of a sorceress, you offspring of an adulterer and a prostitute. Goodness me. He paints it in the most colourful terms, doesn't he? And in some ways you might feel sorry for those people. I think it's the case for anyone here who's actually the son of a sorceress or has been born to a prostitute. But of course there's some who are. And of course we feel sorry for them in a sense because they didn't choose it, did they? They didn't choose the sinful situation that they were born into. But we're all born into sin one way or another. It may have those colourful labels, the son of a sorceress. Goodness me, the offspring of an adulterer and a harlot. But then in the end of verse 4 he sort of brings it down to earth a bit more. The children of transgression. Isn't that everyone? The offspring of falsehood. Isn't that all of us? We were all born in sin. And that grim reality of it. And we're all born in sin because we're the offspring, we're the children of Adam and Eve. And from the first, our forefather Adam sinned. And so we carry on that family line. It's in our DNA to sin. Well, that perfect DNA that God created has been corrupted by sin. And it's there. It's something we inherit. And it's something that follows on in generations. Those born, especially those born sons of a sorceress. What's the kind of environment they grow up in? The offspring of the adulterer and harlot. Sin is something that's passed on. So we have it. We sometimes say, is it by nature or nurture? But it's both. We're doubly messed up by it. It comes by nature and then by our nurture, growing up in sinful families. Now, our upbringing may not have been that bad to have been brought up by a sorceress or a prostitute, but it wasn't perfect. However well-intentioned our parents may have been, we were sinners by nature and by nurture. And then as we grow up, and we become more capable of sin. We learn to do all sorts of things. We can watch faith, learning all these things as time goes on. But one thing we learn is how to sin. And we fall into different sorts of sin. We fall into different sorts of sin. Here are some that are particularly relevant to Israel. He carries on in verse 5, inflaming yourselves with gods under every green tree. That's kind of a reference to the Old Testament times of worshipping Ashtoreth. That was the green trees that they used to set up shrines underneath and the like. Carries on slaying the children in the valleys. Again, that was another god that they sort of inherited from the countries around, the god Molech. And he commanded children to be sacrificed. And Israel had gone off the track, away from God's ways, and ended up doing that sort of thing, slaying even their own children in the valleys to this horrible false god. That was some of the sins that they fell into. He carries on later on in verse 7 and 8, talking about them setting up beds on a high mountain. That's often where they went up to worship Baal in the old days of Elijah and Elisha, that sort of time, especially King Ahab and Jezebel and the like. They had these areas, these temples, these shrines that were set up on high mountains, and often that went with it was an immorality. Often these the priests and the priestesses at these places were also prostitutes and the like, and that kind of behaviour was encouraged. And those were some of the sins that they fell into, those of idolatry and immorality and the like. But he carries on with other ones. Verse 9, you went to the king with ointment and increased your perfumes. You sent messengers far off. We've come across that before in Isaiah. How they would send off, there was all this trouble brewing. Assyria was on their borders and so on, looking very threatening. And rather than trusting in God, they kept trying to get on the right side of Egypt and other countries nearby, try and butter them up to come and see if they could come and help protect Israel. Sending off the ointments and the spices and the things to try and put their trust in a bigger army. If only they could have the right alliance with a big nation down the road, well, that would keep them safe. Trusting in politics, trusting in diplomacy, rather than the Lord. So there's different sorts of sins that we may fall into. But at the root, it comes down to the fact that we do not remember and fear God. There in verse 11, and of whom have you been afraid or feared that you've lied and not remembered me, nor taken it to your heart? That's what it all comes down to. We're born in sin, we learn to sin, we have a sinful upbringing, we become more capable as we grow up. And we might go off in different directions. There may be different temptations that we're susceptible to. And we fall into different sorts of sin. But underpinning it all is that we do not remember God. And we do not fear him. That's what it says there to us in verse 11. We don't remember him. Isn't that the case as well? It's not just something that applied to Old Testament Israel, was it? Isn't that true for each of us when we fall into sin? Does it not have that at its underlying cause, even those of us who are believers, that we did not remember the Lord? Or at least we put him to one side, on the back burner perhaps, and we just forgot all about him and headed off and did our own thing, whatever it might be. Underpinning it is as well is that we do not remember him. And we do not fear him. Doesn't that underpin every time we fall into sin? No matter how long we've been a Christian, that we didn't fear God. It may just be an idle mistake, a carelessness on our part as Christians. We're caught up in the heat of the moment and we say something angry, or we think something lustful, or we just get overcome in the moment that God's not there in the centre of our thoughts. And sometimes it may be deliberately. Sometimes we can deliberately sin, even as believers. And we know that God does not want us to do that. And yet we go and do it anyway. We don't fear him enough. We say, well, I know I shouldn't, but I just really want to. God will understand. Yeah. Let's not think too much about him at the moment, because I want to do this. Isn't that what we do too? What else do we do? Well, he says it in a different way in verse 4. That we rebel and mock God. There in verse 4, whom do you ridicule? Against whom do you make a wide mouth and stick out the tongue? Again, Isaiah does it in the most colourful way. Who is it who does that? Does a wide mouth and sticks out their tongue? Isn't it a child? Isn't it what a toddler does? Or a young child? Their parent says, oh, I want you to go and tidy away your shoes or pick up those clothes in your room or whatever it is. And the child, I'm not. And they stick out their tongue. Ever done it? If you can think, remember that far back? Sticking out a tongue. And what is that when we do it to somebody? Isn't it a mark of disrespect? Is it a mark of defiance? Isn't it a mark of rebellion? I don't want to. And so we stick out the tongue, as it were. And well, says Isaiah, we do the same thing to God. We may not do it literally, stick out our tongue to God, but we rebel. We rebel and we mock him. Everyone does these things. Carries on in verse 11, that we do not take it to heart, and because of God's peace, because of God's patience, because of the fact that we can sin and God doesn't immediately strike us down or bring some terrible consequence to our action, we mistake God's peace and his patience. And because there's no great comeuppance for our sin, sometimes it can encourage us to do it again. We misunderstand his patience and his kindness with us. And we fear other things. He says there in verse 11, of whom have you been afraid or feared? Because at the end of verse 11, you've not feared me. We fear other things instead. We fear what other people might think. We feel threatened by peer pressure or the people who are around us. And we fear and we think about other things. Rather than prioritising God, we prioritise money. And that becomes our big concern. If only I had a bit more in the bank. We become concerned about a pleasure. If only I'd have a bit more time off. Do this or buy that or whatever it is. We could turn to all these other things instead. In chapter 56 and the last couple of verses, he turns his attention to the leaders. The leaders. We looked at it a couple of weeks ago on a Sunday morning, how Paul uses the same language, that I'm innocent of the blood of all men. I've been a watchman who sounded the alarm. We looked at it a couple of Sundays ago on a Sunday morning. Well, here's the opposite in Isaiah, that they're a watchman, verse 10, and they're blind and ignorant. They're blind to the danger that's coming. And they don't, and they can't, sound the alarm. And they don't care anyway. Verse 12, that they're taken up instead with selfishness and excess and pride. We can all have those things. We value other things more. But here in these verses, we're warned about the danger. We're warned about the danger. What is coming? And it'll be summed up with a couple of different D's. It's danger. It's disaster. It's death. Is there in 56 verse 9? Come all you beasts of the field, come to devour. There's, well, the beasts are invited to come to this disaster, this devouring that is going to happen. Again at the end of chapter 57 and verse 20. But the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There is no peace, says my God, for the wicked. What's coming our way? What's coming to those who are sinners? But disaster, danger, and no peace. No peace for those who are sinners. Well, it's in that, this two chapters that we're looking at, there in the centre it has this such grim and bleak description of the human race, and a bleak and grim description of us. That around it, at the beginning and end, beginning of chapter 56 and the end more of chapter 57, comes this beautiful, this gracious invitation. And that's what we'll look at next. So number two, the gracious invitation. And who's invited? Well, here in 56, verse 3. Do not let the son of the foreigner, who's joined himself to the Lord, speak, saying, the Lord has utterly separated me from his people. Or let the eunuch say, here I am a dry tree. It's particularly addressed to those. The foreigner, verse 3. Again, he mentions him in verse 6, the sons of the foreigner. He addresses it to the eunuch. End of verse 3. And then the beginning of verse 4. Again, two mentions of the eunuch. And perhaps Isaiah thinks of them in particular. Because in Old Testament times, they were largely excluded. They were largely excluded from the life of Israel. There wasn't meant to be the case. There was meant to be some opportunities for the foreigners to come into the temple and things like that. But it was very difficult. Imagine living in a time when there's quite fierce nationalism and there's quite a suspicion of outsiders. Imagine living at that sort of time. Then think of it in terms of Isaiah's day when there was also hostility, when there were lots of enemies around. How do people start viewing foreigners then? And so foreigners would always be sort of shunned. There were a handful, you know, in the Old Testament, who were brought into God's people, but it only really seemed to be a handful. And largely, perhaps, it was the experience that foreigners were not very much welcomed. And God's people were somewhat neglectful of that. But here goes out the invitation to the foreigners. Don't say, God's excluded me. God's utterly cut me off and separated himself from me and his people. No, come, the foreigner, join yourself to the Lord. Again, the invite goes out to the eunuch. Again, in their day and age, there were different bits of the temple. And if you had a disability, you weren't allowed into the special, most special parts. And again, there was a suspicion, especially back in those days, of people who were disfigured, people who had disabilities and things like that. And the eunuch was somebody who was shunned. They couldn't raise a family. They were a loner, almost by definition of becoming a eunuch, for whatever reason. And they would be shunned, ridiculed. Somebody who was different, somebody who was odd. Somebody who didn't share in the normal life of everyone else. But here, God's invitation goes out to them. You see, God's invitation goes out to everyone. Who's invited? There's all sorts of answers here in Isaiah 56. It's the foreigner, it's the eunuch, and it's everyone, verse 6, everyone who keeps from defiling the Sabbath and holds fast my commandment. God's gracious invitation goes out to sinners, to everyone. God welcomes and God invites. And what does God promise? Well, here through Isaiah 56 and 57, there are these beautiful pictures that Isaiah takes up as God gives him this vision. Verse 5, even to them I'll give my house. What was it a eunuch would want? Wouldn't it be a home? Wouldn't it be a family? What about the foreigner? The alien? They were sometimes referred to, wasn't they, in the AV and the like. Somebody who is viewed with suspicion and contempt, they can come home. A home, that's what God promises. There in verse 5, I'll give them a place in my house, within my walls, a place and a name. God offers, he sends out this gracious invitation to come home, to come and come into his home, and they'll be given a place there in it, and they'll be given a name. A name. What names do people call foreigners? They're not nice ones, are they? Especially when there's some racism, especially when there's a fierce nationalism, especially when there's hostility for these other ethnic groups and races and people from other nationalities and places coming there. What do people talk about them? Mankind have invented the horriblest things, haven't they? To call people from other races and other countries that they don't like. Here God gives them a great name. And a better name, he says, than sons and daughters. He gives them a precious name. Again, what do people call eunuchs and people with disabilities? Again, people trying to become more politically correct. But forget politically correct. It's biblically correct. Hearing this, that God welcomes them and gives them a name. No longer are they derided and horrible remarks made against them because of their disability or their disfigurement or whatever it is. God gives them a name. A precious name, a loved name, because it's the name that's like but better than sons and daughters. And a better name than that, and they'll not be cut off. It won't come to an end. So they're given a home, they're given a name, and it cannot end. It cannot be cut off. Carries on verse 7. I'll bring them to my holy mountain. That's again another familiar Isaiah picture. They can come to the mountain. In some ways looking to Jerusalem, where the temple was, the mountain there, the mountain, Mount Zion and so on. But in a sense, it was there. They could come to this holy mount, but Isaiah pictures it in such bigger ways than that. How all the nations will come to the mountain of the Lord. They'll be accepted. Their offerings will be accepted. Carries on verse 7, I'm going to make them joyful. Another promise. They're going to be given joy. Their prayer will be accepted. My house will be a house of prayer. There again in verse 8, the Lord God who gathers the outcasts of Israel, say, yet I will gather to him, to the Saviour. More of that later. Others beside those who are gathered to him. More. It's not finished. Out goes the gracious invitation to the foreigner and the eunuch. But the invitation is going out and out and out until it's finished. The invitation goes on because it's not finished yet. In chapter 57, he pictures it in verse 14. One shall say, heap it up, prepare the way. Again, another picture of Isaiah getting the road ready. Another thing they're promised, a road, a path to tread on, a path that will take them to God, a path that they should walk in. There are these wonderful pictures that it is given to them. Again, later on in verse 18, I've seen his ways and I'll heal him. Another promise, healing that God will give. I will lead him and restore comfort to him and his mourners. He'll bring healing, he'll bring comfort. Verse 19, he'll bring peace. Peace. What a wonderful promise that God gives. So many different pictures that are there. And what an amazing thing that is. Coming back to where we began, that all of us are bad. Coming back to this grim picture of the reality of the human race and the reality of me. The reality of you. What a wonderful thing it is. Because, and if the children want to turn the page, on the other side, what is God like? What is God like? Well, look in chapter 57 and verse 15. For thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. Four things we're told about God. He's high. He's lofty. He inhabits eternity. And his name is holy. Four things we're told about God. What is God like? He's high and lofty, so far above us. He inhabits eternity. He's always lived in eternity because he's the eternal one. It's his. It's the place. It's eternal. It's where he is. And he dwells in the holy place. And his name is holy. What is God like? And yet this invitation goes out so that we can come near to him. He invited the foreigner and the eunuch and us and everyone to come to him. What an amazing thing that is. That the high and lofty one should send an invite down here to those who are anything but, to those who are low and worthless. The Eternal One sends an invitation to those who are so short in our span of life. The Holy One sent his gracious words to sinners. The God who is these amazing four things sends a message to us. And he says the most astonishing thing there in verse 15. For thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place with him. Aren't those two amazing words? That the God who dwells in the high and holy place would live there with people. Isn't that astonishing? That God would welcome, that God would invite people to live with him? Well, what do we have to be? Do we long for that? Do we long to be there at home? Do we long to dwell with God? Well, it carries on in that verse. I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit. What do we have to be accepted, to go and live in that place with the high and lofty one, in that holy place? We're told two things. We have to be contrite and humble. Contrite means broken. Humble means bowing. What do we have to be? We have to be contrite and humble. We have to be broken. We have to realise how sinful we are. We have to realise what a mess we've made of things. Realise we're broken. And we have to bow. We have to be humble. Now, we deserve anger. Carries on in verse 16. I will not always be angry. So it's in verse 17, for the iniquity of his covetousness, I was angry and struck him, I hid and was angry. That's what we deserve. We deserve anger. But instead God gives mercy. I will not always be angry, he says. He says there back in verse 15 again, I dwell with him who has a contrite and humble spirit to revive the spirit of the humble. And revive the heart of the contrite one. God gives his mercy. And we can enter into his presence. We can enter his presence. What a wonderful thing it is. And those promises we've just been looking at. Those promises of a home. Those promises of a name. Those promises of healing and comfort and peace. To be revived. To have new life. That's the promise that God gives. As we said already, we're all bad. But are we repentant? Are we humble? Are we contrite? Again, in chapter 57, verse 1 and 2. The righteous perishes and no man takes it to heart. Merciful men are taken away, while no one considers that the righteous is taken away from evil. He spared it, and he shall enter into peace. That's the promise. And they're entering it. They're entering in. Jesus takes up many of these same themes in the very famous Sermon on the Mount and in the Beatitudes. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Jesus takes up the same theme. Poor in spirit, merciful, humble, hungry, thirsting. They're welcomed into God's presence. This wonderful, this beautiful invitation goes out. Is it an invitation you've heard? Is it an invitation that you've responded to? Have we heard this wonderful invitation to be welcomed into God's presence? And it's okay because it's an invitation that goes out to the bad. And that's me and you, isn't it? If we come humbly, if we come broken, knowing our failures, if we come repentant, asking for his mercy. Then thirdly, and just very briefly to finish off, what do we do as a result? The life of the repentant. How should we live if we are those? If there's two groups of people, there's the bad and there's the repentant. How should the repentant live? He gives us a few things here. Chapter 56, verse 1. Keep justice, do righteousness, for my salvation is about to come, and my righteousness to be revealed. Blessed is the man who does it, and the Son of Man who lays hold of it. Justice, righteousness. Again, chapter 57, verse 1. The righteous perishes, and the merciful men. What should we prioritise in our lives? Those of us who are repentant, those of us who are living, longing to be in God's presence, seek justice, righteousness, mercy in the little things, in the big things, seeking those things that matter to God. How else should we live? Well, one thing that goes across there in chapter 56 is these mentions of the Sabbath. 56 verse 2, the one who keeps from defiling the Sabbath. Again in verse 4 and again in verse 6. I think in some ways it's talking about organising your life for God. He talks about the foreigner who sets aside the Sabbath. And all those who do that, yes, there's a great priority of the Lord's Day, but what is it for the foreigner? It's reorganising the whole of life, isn't it? In God's instructions, to follow God's commandments. Organising our life to follow God. Whether that's our Sunday and our time, whether that's our money, whether that's the rest of the hours in the week, it's organising our time, organising life for God. And it's also entering into his blessings now. The Sabbath was a day of rest. It was a day of blessing. And so as we do those things, we enjoy those things that God has promised us now. The life of the repentant is following in God's ways, following his priorities, and enjoying his blessings, and being filled with a loving obedience. It says there in verse 6, those who join themselves to the Lord to serve him, and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants. Everyone who keeps from defiling the Sabbath and holds fast my covenant. How should we live? Those of us who are repentant. Shouldn't we love the name of the Lord and want to be his servants? It's a loving obedience. It's not a hard burden that he's given us to bear. But we love his name. And so we want to serve him. And we want to follow in his ways. Here in these verses we've been looking at this evening, we see this gracious invitation of God. An invitation to those of us who are sinners. A welcome into his home. A welcome into his family. And a welcome into the life that he's prepared for us. A life down here of living for him, loving him and serving him. And then those beautiful promises. When we'll be with him in glory and have that home with him. The presence that he gives, have that new life, that healing, that comfort that he'll bring to those who are repentant. There's two groups of people, the bad and the repentant. Those who know they're bad and those who turn to the Lord humbly, pleading for his mercy, trusting in the Lord Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of their sins. Let's sing of that cross. It's hymn number 555 in our hymn books. It just reminds us of that great mercy that God has had on us. It's number 555, O Teach Me What It Meaneth. And then after this hymn, take a seat again, and we'll have a 5-10 minutes that we can spend together in prayer. So let's sing together number 555.
What it meaneth, that cross uplifted.